Jawad alayhi salam spoke with his companions, of course, about many different things. But one of the things that we find which is interesting throughout all of the divinely appointed immaculate and infallible imams alayhim assalam is this idea that they spoke with things that were relevant to their time. So meaning if a certain thing was an issue or a problem during their time, during their imamah, then of course they would talk about that and they would address that. It's not like the imams would address problems from the past, but they would ignore the problems of the present. Now, it is possible that they spoke about problems from the past, but never at the detriment or never at the cost of the problems of the present. And of course, we find that in some of the traditions, they have even spoken about the problems of the future, but again, never at the cost of not talking about the problems of the present, because it is the problems of the present that they need to address, that they need to correct, they need to rectify, and they need to reform. Now, as we had said in some previous programs, of course, the era of the father and the previously divinely appointed imam, Imam Ali ibn Musa al-Ridha alayhi salam, faced an influx of different ideologies and philosophies and religious ideas and different sects of the Muslims. This was again handed down to Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam. Now, in this kind of a situation, you find that there's a lot of people that are doing a lot of talking. There's a lot of debating going on. There's a lot of, speaking going on. There's a lot of conversation, a lot of dialogue, and in many cases, a lot of arguments, a lot of fights. And of course, arguments and fights, if they increase to a political and governmental level, then it turns into killing and murder. And so in one of these conversations where these things about speaking and akhlaq and moral and ethical virtues and what one should do and what one shouldn't do were being spoken about, at one point Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam, he says that the murder of man is between his two jaws. So we're talking about the top jaw and the bottom jaw. Those are the two jaws, right? The mandible in anatomy, as it is called. Now, what is in between these two jaws? Of course, it is the tongue. Now, the tongue is very well, it can be used as a weapon to defend Islam, and at the same time, it can be used as a weapon to attack Islam. It all depends upon the one who is wielding the sword. In this case, the one who is wielding the tongue. But in many cases, the murder of a human being is due to this tongue, which is in between the two jaws. Now, most of the time, the people of falsehood are not necessarily murdered because of what they are saying. Even though, yes, it is true, when you find some of the battles between truth and falsehood, falsehood is vanquished because it uses its tongue in order to promote propaganda and lies and deception and the like. But on the other hand, we also have many instances where speaking the truth has led to the murder of a human being, in our terms, to the shahada, the martyrdom of a human being. It is because of speaking the truth that many people in the world are ostracized, or they are tormented, they are tortured, they are punished, and of course they are killed. And so a very beautiful interpretation of a very beautiful tradition from Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam is that the murder of a human being is between their two jaws. This is dialogue, Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam.
Parts of Ziyarat Text of Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam.
As-salamu alayka ayyuha an-nur as-sati, as-salamu alayka
Peace be upon you, O shining lights. Peace be upon you, O rising full moon. Peace be upon you, O pure one from among the pure ones. Peace be upon you, O immaculate from among the immaculate ones. Peace be upon you, O pleased and pure. Peace be upon you, O Abba Ja'far, Muhammad, the son of Ali, the righteous, the pious, the faithful leader, and Allah's mercy and blessings be upon you.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.ir/en, Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many other great programs as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
At a rate of 6%, inflation in France is still at its worst since the 1980s. However, new data shows that all-important food prices continue to push to unseen levels, having leapt a whopping 16% since last year.
I'm a shopkeeper, but I also grow wheat and raise cattle. So I can tell you that those who are raising their prices the most are the big corporations. The small producers suffered and tried for a long time not to raise their prices. But now everyone is raising their prices. For example, chicken is up 30% this year.
From April through June, there will be price caps on certain goods, following last month's acceptance by major retailers and middlemen of a government initiative. It's expected to cost them hundreds of millions of euros. However, many say they can afford it. Ever-increasing corporate profits have been the norm across Europe since 2009. And in the post-COVID world, many analysts say that corporate price gouging, government-approved speculation, and stockholder profit hoarding are the hidden driver of Europe's high prices.
Il faut prendre des mesures autoritaires.
We must take authoritarian measures. There's simply no other way. We must implement price controls, the indexing of wages to prices, and much more. But a government must have the will to do such things. And that takes us back to the necessity of choosing an alternative political path than our current model.
Polls show that 96% of France agrees with the statement that some suppliers are opportunistically taking advantage of inflation. Opportunism aside, the soaring prices are the enduring result of the West's failed sanctions campaign against Russia over the long-term unrest in the Ukraine. Instead of sowing peace and reaping low prices, the European Union is finding that belligerence backfires, and especially for the average person. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Israel's atrocities against Palestinians have intensified during the holy month of Ramadan, including the recent savage attack on worshippers at Al-Aqsa Mosque. The regime in Tel Aviv has been condemned in the European Parliament.
We haven't as much as sanctioned them in any way. We have occupied territories
where we import products from, we have sent no signals to Israel that we condemn what they are doing.
Compared to previous debates on the subject, it appears more and more EU legislators are willing to call Israel out.
We see growing violence, expansion plans for illegal settlements, a de facto annexation turning into a covert de jure annexation, daily discrimination against Palestinians, demolitions.
It is clear that the regime still enjoys much support in the European Parliament.
To be honest, I feel strong sympathy with Israel.
However, many EU lawmakers express support for protesters who have been taken to the streets of Israel in huge numbers.
The Prime Minister has to guarantee that hate speech against political opponents and extremist positions expressed by cabinet ministers do not further encourage a circle of violence.
Campaigners suggest regime members are currently under pressure like never before.
The Zionist entity is in a serious crisis, mainly because of the Palestinian resistance, but also because of the resistance in the region, from Iran to Iraq to Al-Yemen to Lebanon, and also Palestinians' diaspora.
It's claimed anyone with a mobile phone who criticizes Israeli authorities is now a potential target.
The Pegasus spyware developed and distributed by an Israeli company is being widely used to target human rights defenders, journalists and political opponents across the world, including in our union.
Despite the obvious challenges, rights campaigners remain optimistic. They insist it's not a matter of if Palestinians will ever see freedom, liberation and victory, but when. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The price of a month's worth of rent in the British capital has soared by an average of more than 16% over the past year, with the average rent price reaching a record $2,910 a month, the highest in the country. In other big cities, such as in Manchester, it's gone up to more than 20%, and in Birmingham, more than 17%. Alex, who asked not to be identified, shared a house in West London with his partner and another couple for 2 years, but had to move when the rent skyrocketed.
The contract that we originally had was 3 years with a two-year break clause. Our original contract state being £2,800 a month, but we had an email from our landlord stating that it's going to be increased to £4,000, which I think is a little over 40%.
Property experts say higher mortgage interest rates and taxation are forcing landlords to either increase the rent or withdraw their properties from the market, sending renters fighting over available properties.
It's really not a good time for tenants and renters in general. We've seen that any one property will have multiple offers. Just recently, we did a viewing on a flat, two-bedroom flat in Ruislip, West London, where we did 14 viewings and we have 14 offers.
But what is the reason behind the increase in demand? A housing deficit is one reason. Britain has a backlog of 4.3 million homes that are missing from the national housing market, as they were never built. Another is a rise in net migration.
So now that's because of Ukraine, refugees coming in from there. It's also because of the situation with Hong Kong and because of the increases in the numbers of international students coming into the UK as well. Groups of people, they tend to move into places like London or big cities like Birmingham or Manchester.
Calls for a rent freeze are growing, but that is yet to happen. And pressures on the rental market are not expected to ease anytime soon. Saeed Pariza, London.
Iran has marked its National Army Day, with forces from all units of armed forces holding parades in major cities, including the capital, Tehran. Combat units of the army, helicopters, fighter jets, air defense systems, and portable naval equipment took part in the parades. Also, indigenously developed military equipment, including drones and missiles, were displayed. Addressing the event, Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi hailed the achievements made by Iran's armed forces, saying any threat to Iran's security will get quick and powerful response.
The Iranian armed forces ensure security not only for their own country, but for the entire region. The Iranian army is now equipped with state-of-the-art technologies to defend territorial integrity. The extra-regional and American forces should leave the region as soon as possible because it is in their own interests and in the interests of the region. The enemy, especially the Zionist regime, have received this message that the slightest move against the country will evoke a severe response from the armed forces and will be accompanied by the destruction of Haifa and Tel Aviv.
Iranian military experts and technicians have in recent years made great headways in manufacturing a broad range of equipment, making the armed forces self-sufficient in the arms sphere.
The army has been furnished with new weaponry, equipment and technologies that are necessary for fighting the contemporary wars and appropriate for the possible wars of future. The Iranian armed forces are now able to fight off any power intending to violate the country's territories, commit an act of aggression, or upset the balance of power.
Iran maintains that its military power poses no threat to the regional countries, saying that the Islamic Republic's defense doctrine is entirely based on deterrence. The National Army Day, which is celebrated annually on April 18th, was named by the founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Imam Khomeini, back in 1979.
The latest achievements displayed by different units of the Army of the Islamic Republic of Iran were only part of Iran's military might, which has been made possible thanks to the efforts of Iranian engineers and specialists. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
On Palestinian Prisoners' Day, marked every April 17th, protesters in Paris demanded an end to Western silence regarding Israel's horrific and illegal treatment of political prisoners. Since 1948, an estimated 1 million Palestinians have been arrested by Israelis due to waging an average of 10 police raids every single day. Israel arrests about 6,000 adults and 1,000 children annually. A new report revealed that 5,000 Palestinians are currently held in long-term Israeli prisons, including almost 200 children. More than 1,000 people have not even been charged with an alleged crime. Prisoners report that physical and psychological torture is not just routine, but shockingly brutal, and hundreds of Palestinians have died in Israeli custody. Many accuse the international community and Western-led human rights groups of abandoning those ensnared in Israeli occupation prisons.
The image of Israel is getting worse and worse with each passing day. What some don't seem to grasp is that Israel is a colonial project, and all of modern human history shows that the colonialists are the guilty ones, and not those who are colonized. The only choice Israel has is to stop its attempt to colonize Palestine.
Europe's longest-serving political prisoner is a pro-Palestinian resistance fighter held in France, Georges Ibrahim Abdullah, who has become lionized as the Arab Nelson Mandela. Abdullah still refuses to recant his support for Palestine, and his continued imprisonment is widely viewed as a flagrant politicization of France's legal system.
The mistreatment and unjust incarceration of Georges Abdullah shows how France is directly involved in today's Middle Eastern politics. Releasing Abdullah back to Lebanon would threaten French imperialist and political interests in the region, and also those of its allies in the United States and Israel. Abdullah is a hero worldwide, and we insist on his immediate parole, which was initially granted over 20 years ago.
In neighboring Germany, protests in favor of Palestinian Prisoners' Day were banned. The Israeli occupation means that Palestinians endure terrorist tactics every single day. The brutality is even worse for those political prisoners stuck in Israeli jails. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Thousands of pro-Palestine activists from across the UK marched on Downing Street Sunday to mark the International Quds Day. They joined millions of other demonstrators engaging in similar action all across the globe, with the aim of empowering the Palestinian cause and condemning Zionism, the political ideology endeavouring to forcefully evict Palestinians from their historic homeland.
Initiated by the Islamic Republic of Iran in 1979, International Quds Day is marked on the last Friday of the holy month of Ramadan. However, in recent years in Europe, the day has come under attack, with critics trying to get the day back. And outright.
Pro-Israel activists say the march is anti-Semitic, an accusation dismissed by organizers and attendees, including anti-Zionist religious Jews.
Those who conflate Judaism with Zionism, they are the ones who are being anti-Semitic, because they are the ones who are trying to turn a nuanced, thousands of years long history of a religion into one monolith for political reasons.
We have lived thousands of years with Muslims, with Arabs, without peace and any problem. This is nothing to do. We are standing for justice. There's no justice in what's going on here. I'm talking to the whole world now. It's not only, unfortunately, here the victims are Palestinian people. And the international community know this. And they're not doing anything for God knows why.
And the fact that Almighty mentioned Al-Aqsa in the Quran, it is a religious obligation to protect and safeguard this location and this place. And not only that, wherever there is pain and suffering, like there is oppression and zulm, and the people are living under occupation. So it becomes even more important as a religious obligation to really do whatever we can.
According to reports, German authorities have banned the rally for the third consecutive year, due to be held in Berlin on April the 15th. Efforts to ban the procession here in London have so far remained fruitless. Many attendees believe the march is the last true space platforming free speech to criticise Israel and the ideology behind it, something which is rarely platformed elsewhere. Robert Carter, London.
Illegal US sanctions on Iran are opening new windows of opportunities to do business with other countries. Following a recent visit by Iran's Deputy Foreign Minister for Economic Diplomacy, Mehdi Safari, New Delhi and Tehran are exploring new areas of trade. Despite the sanctions, the two countries have vowed to improve trade relations, especially in transport, IT, pharmaceuticals, biotechnology, culture, education and tourism. The two nations are now looking for options to boost joint manufacturing across industries.
India and Iran can have a joint ventures as far as processing is concerned, processing of semi-manufactured and manufactured industrial products, processing and manufacturing of semiconductors and electronics products. And Iran is a very conducive country to have electronics industry on a big scale.
Experts say the Iranian port of Chabahar could be a focal point for investments and will help boost trade with India, Afghanistan, Armenia, Azerbaijan, Russia, Central Asia and Europe. India is among Iran's top five trade partners. Their bilateral trade is currently worth $1.3 billion. Imports and exports include rice, tea, sugar, fresh fruits, pharmaceuticals, soft drinks and industrial machinery, among others. The two countries are planning to triple their trade over the next 5 years.
While the sanctions may remain as they are, and countries may have, like say, Indo and the U.S., their relationship may continue as it is on mutual interest based. But at the same time, they can overcome certain shortcomings while having trade and bilateral ventures between Iran and India in spite of those bottlenecks. Like, say, the Europe and Russia, they are trading in oil despite the American sanctions and the Ukraine policy.
Iran's Deputy Foreign Minister Safari said exports to India grew 60% in 2022 and are becoming increasingly independent of oil. Expressing his country's willingness to meet India's energy needs, he said the two nations enjoy huge potential and opportunities to invest in infrastructure, tourism, as well as manufacturing projects. Iran has also offered to extend a subsea natural gas pipeline from Oman to India.
India and Iran are continuing consultations for trade in local currencies, as well as an alternate payment settlement mechanism to SWIFT. Experts say historic Indo-Iran relations have much room for improvement. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
Shia jurisprudence or Shia thoughts and beliefs is a subject that used to be taught in national educational centers in mostly Shia settling areas of Afghanistan. But now, the Ministry of Higher Education in Afghanistan has decided to exclude the subject from educational system. The Council of Shia Scholars has negotiated the matter with the ministry, saying the decision is detrimental.
Applying restriction on the followers of a religion has countless disadvantages, especially on national unity. Such restrictions also deprive a certain population of their absolute rights. Naturally, when people are deprived of their rights, they might not show proper cooperation with the government because people expect their government not to ignore their rights.
The Ministry of Higher Education says it's committed to providing good and necessary services to all citizens of the country, but it cannot implement this case for some reasons.
Three days after our negotiations with the Ministry of Higher Education, they announced that they excluded Shia jurisprudence because they want to make a single curriculum for education throughout the country. They also said teaching two jurisprudences might sparkle unrest among students. But of course, none of these reasons are acceptable to us, as we have seen Shia jurisprudence was taught for years in the country without causing any problem. Anyway, we will continue to claim our rights from the legal standpoint.
The Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan is under immense pressure by the international community to create an inclusive government and to respect the rights of minorities. With the education system in Afghanistan being highly controversial since the Taliban took power, especially after the group barred girls from going to school and university, many believe that implementing such measure have contributed to the international isolation of the Taliban. Abdullah Mirzadeh, Kabul.
Under the watchful gaze of South Africa's own anti-apartheid icons, they came out to highlight the plight of the Palestinian people again. For decades, many of those here have marched annually to the gates of Parliament, demanding decisive action from the government, which itself fought a racist supremacist regime once.
We need to break diplomatic ties with Israel, as well as economic ties with them. They should become a pariah state. We shouldn't have any sort of diplomatic visits to Israel, as well as from Israel. And they should be made to feel demonized on a global scale.
In a groundbreaking move just weeks ago, Parliament passed a motion to downgrade ties with the Israeli regime. But questions remain whether the ANC-led government will see this through. After years of advocating neutrality, South Africa took a more resolute stance against Israel at the African Union, preventing the Zionist regime from gaining observer status. Representatives from the ruling party participated in the International Quds Day march to Parliament here and agreed more needs to be done.
We need legal action, both from United Nations. There's a duplicity of especially Western countries around this matter. It's very clear that Israel is being isolated on this. The Middle East is coming too. There's a strong, overwhelming critical mass of all countries and freedom-loving people saying that enough is enough and this atrocities must stop. So we as South Africa, we call on this. We believe this. We will be continuing to fight for the cause of the Palestinian people.
South Africa withdrew its ambassador from Israel in 2018, but the Israeli ambassador still enjoyed full diplomatic status here. The parliamentary motion pledges to expel Tel Aviv's representative and downgrade the embassy to a liaison office. Underpinned by the vision of International Quds Day for those who have protested here annually, the latest moves are a victory indeed. Hassan Siri, Cape Town.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
هدایت میکنه.
It guides us through life.
همه چیز رو تعلیم داده.
It has taught us everything.
باید آموخت. باید فهمید.
We should learn and appreciate what it gives us.
و اونگاه پیاده کردن این مفاهیم در واقعیت زندگی.
And try to apply them to our daily lives.
چجوری ممکنه؟
How is it possible?
از راه قرآن.
By means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من. این قدم آخر نیست.
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step, brothers, not the last one.
هو الذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين.
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth, that he may make it prevail over all religions, though the polytheists should be averse.
والذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين الحق ليظهره على الدين كله ولو كره المشركون.
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش، با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد، موسیقی خاصی دارد، روش خاصی دارد، اینها چیزای لازم نیست.
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones.
اما این کافی نیست.
But it's not enough.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن. دوری از قرآن. از قرآن.
Muslims' major problem is losing touch with the Quran. Quran. Quran.
کتاب الله.
In the limelight.
According to experts, frequent mass shooting incidents in the United States create a sense of insecurity for the American people and force the U.S. public to purchase more weaponry to supposedly maintain their security, a vicious cycle that keeps on producing more violence. We have taken a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. U.S. national broadcaster NBC News has covered this story and tells us more. Former U.S. President Donald Trump says mass shooting incidents are not a gun problem as he vows to defend and expand gun ownership rights in a speech to the main American gun lobby's annual meeting. Donald Trump said to an audience at the National Rifle Association's NRA's meeting on Friday, 14th of April, in Indianapolis, he said, I was proud to be the most pro-gun, pro-Second Amendment president you've ever had in the White House. Donald Trump added, and with your support in 2024, I will be your loyal friend and fearless champion once again as the 47th president of the United States. A plethora of 2024 Republican presidential hopefuls and possible candidates rushed to pledge their loyalty to the National Rifle Association, before several thousand gun rights activists in a hall at the convention center in Indianapolis, against the backdrop of recent mass shooting incidents in Tennessee and Kentucky. The Republicans ridiculed the notion of gun and ammunition restrictions would reduce violence. Former President Donald Trump said, "It is a scandal and a tragedy that year after year, Democrats in Washington continue to hold common sense school safety measures hostage to their radical gun control agenda, which in virtually all cases would do nothing to prevent attacks by demented and disturbed individuals. As he batted cleanup for a long list of Republican officials and office seekers, he claimed, "This is not a gun problem. This is a mental health problem. This is a social problem. This is a cultural problem. And this is a spiritual problem." The website Politico has also covered this story and tells us more. Mass shootings have become commonplace in the United States. According to the Gun Violence Archive, there has been 146 incidents so far in 2023, the most at this point in the year since 2016. The non-profit group Gun Violence Archive defines a mass shooting incident as four or more shots or people killed, not including the shooter. According to data published on Tuesday by KFF, a non-profit research organization formerly known as the Kaiser Family Foundation, one in five American adults report having been personally threatened with a firearm. Democrats and gun safety activists have argued that the passing stricter laws would reduce violence, whereas Republicans and gun rights advocates argue that arming teachers in schools would act as a deterrent. The United States, a country of around 330 million people, is awash with some 400 million guns. Efforts to ban assault rifles have faced opposition from Republicans, who are staunch supporters of the constitutional right to bear firearms. A Gallup opinion poll from October of 2022 showed the majority of Americans are in favor of gun control laws, with a 57% majority of all Americans saying they want stricter laws covering the sale of firearms. In the wake of the recent mass shooting incidents, some Republicans have changed their tune. Republican Governor Bill Lee publicly urged the Tennessee state legislature to pass a version of a red flag law in the state. That's a policy former U.S. Vice President Mike Pence once embraced when he was governor of Indiana. But as a potential presidential contender today, Mike Pence said America doesn't need gun control, but rather crime control. Mike Pence added, "We don't need lectures about the liberties of law-abiding citizens. We need solutions to protect our kids." So to Joe Biden and the gun control extremists, I say, give up on your pipe dreams of gun confiscation, stop endangering our lives with gun bans, and stop trampling on our God-given rights guaranteed by the United States' Constitution. The Reuters news agency has also covered this story and tells us more. After two mass shooting incidents killed people in Louisville, Kentucky and Nashville, Tennessee, political leaders recently called for tighter gun control laws, including tougher laws preventing people in crisis from accessing firearms. Recently, a bank employee shot dead five colleagues and wounded nine other people at his workplace in Louisville, Kentucky. On 27th of March this year, 3 9-year-olds and 3 staff members were killed at a private Christian school in Nashville, Tennessee, by a former student. Tennessee Governor Bill Lee urged Central Assembly members to find a compromise to bolster the state's so-called red flag laws, aimed at making it more difficult for people deemed to be a threat to the public or themselves from having access to firearms. The Republican governor of Tennessee, Bill Lee, told reporters on Tuesday, 11th of April, "I'm asking the legislature to bring forth thoughtful, practical measures to do that, to strengthen our laws, to separate those dangerous people from firearms, while at the same time preserving the constitutional rights of the people of this state. Such legislation would supplement an existing law allowing courts to bar perpetrators of domestic abuse, sexual assault, and stalking from owning or possessing firearms." Tennessee's Republican Governor Bill Lee's call for cooperation followed the Republican-dominated Assembly's expulsion of two black Democrats who staged a protest in the Tennessee state capitol calling for tighter gun control laws. The governor also said he would sign an executive order requiring local courts to report criminal records to state law enforcement within 72 hours, a measure aimed at more effective screening of those purchasing guns. Tennessee Governor Bill Lee called on the legislature to separate those dangerous people from firearms, while at the same time preserving the constitutional rights of the people of this state. He made the call at a news conference in Nashville on Tuesday. Meanwhile, at a news conference in Louisville, Kentucky, U.S. Representative Morgan McGarvey urged federal lawmakers to support universal background checks. The Democrat said that during his time in the state legislature, he worked with conservative colleagues to introduce laws that would help temporarily remove firearms from people in crisis. U.S. Representative Morgan McGarvey pointed out that the Louisville shooter could have been flagged as a risk, citing reports that the man legally purchased the assault-style rifle he used on 4th of April and texted or called someone to tell them he was suicidal and contemplating harm before carrying out the shooting. The congressman, Morgan McGarvey, said, "We don't have the tools on the books to deal with someone who is an imminent danger to themselves or to others." Mayor Craig Greensburg said at a news conference that the recent shooting incident brought the number of people killed by gun violence in Louisville to 40 in 2023 so far, calling the level of firearms violence in his city beyond horrific. The Democratic mayor, Craig Greensburg, noted that under current Kentucky law, the rifle will one day be legally auctioned off and urged state lawmakers to allow guns used in the deadly shootings to be destroyed. He said, "The laws we have now are enabling violence and murder." According to Kentucky State Police, any person aged 21 or older who is eligible to lawfully possess a firearm can carry a concealed deadly weapon. Addressing the audience at the recent National Rifle Association's meeting, Donald Trump promised, if elected president again, he will roll back existing gun laws and arm teachers and put security guards at the entrance of every school in America. Donald Trump said, "I will ask Congress to repeal totally ineffective legislation that makes it harder to protect our schools and easier for criminals to face absolutely no opposition when they go in a school."
So we can consider Sayyid Hadi Khosro Shahi.
Shahid Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr.
He was born in Kazimiya.
The first and the most important thing that we can learn from Allama Tabatabai is his great effort.
In this regard, I should like to say that one of the great benefits of the late Ayatollah Sayyid Mahmoud Shahrudi was...
When we look at the works of late Rawzati, we see
there is a famous sentence from Mirza Khalil Qamari that he says in Farsi, "Tuhid kalame baraye kalame tuhid."
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in The Teacher.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to the listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page. Well, welcome to another episode of the program The Teacher, an introduction into the thoughts and works of the most outstanding Muslim Shiite scholars and ulama. I am Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio, we have two very special guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Shaykh Rouhani and Shaykh Fadai. Shaykh Rouhani, assalamu alaikum.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
And Shaykh Fadai, assalamu alaikum to you.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Okay, for today's discussion, we want to talk about Sayyid Ali ibn Muhammad, Ali ibn Muhammad Tabatabai Hayri, mainly known as Sahib Riyadh, or the writer of Riyadh. This is because he's the author of Riyadh al-Masail, one of the most outstanding books in the field of fiqh or Islamic jurisprudence. Before getting to his achievements, his scholarly life, let's be more familiar with his early biography and life. Shaykh Rouhani, let's start with you, brother. Give us more information about Sayyid Ali Tabatabai.
Yes, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Sayyid Ali ibn Muhammad Ali Tabatabai Hayri, the full name of this great scholar. He was one of the great jurists or faqih and usuli of the Shia in the 12th and 13th century of, according to the lunar calendar or Islamic calendar. Of course, he was one of the very well-known and popular students of the great ulamas like Wahid Behbahani and the other, let's say, great scholars. Sayyid Ali Tabatabai was born in Qadhimain, which is a city near to Baghdad.
Or Al-Qadhimiyya.
Al-Qadhimiyya, exactly.
Yeah.
And his father was Muhammad Ali, the son of Abu al-Ma'ali. And of course, he was the children of Sadat. His mother and his father, both of them, were among Sadat. That's why they were called Tabatabai. And yes, as it is said about him, that he has written lots of great books and works. Yes. That will be, inshallah, discussed later.
That's right.
Yes, he was finally died in Karbala when he was 70 years old, and he was buried in the holy shrine of Imam Hussein, alayhi salatu wassalam.
That's right. It seems that most of his life, his scholarly life and personal life, have passed in the city of Karbala. Shaykh Fadai, give us a picture of his life in Karbala. How was it? How was his scholarly life over there? What were his main achievements over there?
One of the interesting points about the life of ulama, scholars, is that most of them are famous by their books, the main book. For example, the name is Sayyid Ali Tabatabai, Sayyid Ali ibn Muhammad Tabatabai Ha'iri.
Yes.
But in Hausa, even nowadays, in the lessons of Hausa, he is known by Sahib Riyadh.
Even nowadays, they
even
call
now,
him?
Even now, Sahib they call Riyadh. Sahib Riyadh. Nice. Maybe some of the clergymen, some of the students who doesn't know that his real name is Sayyid Ali Tabatabai.
Okay.
They all know him with the name of Sahib Riyadh.
Like Sayyid Jawahir.
Yeah,
or
like Sahib Jawahir.
Yes, yes.
And most of the students in Hausa doesn't know that his name is Muhammad Hassan Najafi, but in Hausa, most of students, clergymen, know him with the name, with the title Sahib Jawahir. It shows us the great position of knowledge and scientific books. You know, the book is getting so effective in a knowledge like fiqh that all people focus and concentrate on the book more than the author.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, the book is one of the works of that author.
Yes.
But the one which is seen by all students in Hosea
and becomes more popular.
Because more is the greatness of that book, like Sahib Riyadh. You know, and this book, he started to write a book in jurisprudence based on reason, ijtihad. Mm-hmm. When at the time that usually the scholars and faqih, they used to write their works based on narrations, not reasons and ijtihad.
So for our dear listeners, I must say that we have some narrative ijtihad and we have some argumentative.
We can say narrative fiqh.
Fiqh is better
or
to say, yes.
Argumental, yes. And intellectual fiqh.
Yes, 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 yes.
You know, it was a complete course of intellectual fiqh, mm-hmm. based on reason.
Reasoning, that's
a complete
right.
course. At that time, it was so interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Because of that, this book is so famous. And even now, in the lessons of Hoza, in yes. fiqh, as we call it, Dars Kharij,
yes.
always they refer to this book.
Uh-huh. To Riyaz al-Masa'il. Yes.
This book didn't lose the importance
yes.
and the great position up to this day.
Yes. Okay. This is very important. So many fiqhi, we can say, or jurisprudential rulings and issues are discussed by Sayyid Ali Tabatabai in Riyaz al-Masail, as you said, but based on a kind of reasoning or argumentative approach.
Of course, when we say based on reason, it doesn't mean that the scholar doesn't use narration and hadith.
Okay.
They use the verses of Quran,
yes, yes.
the narration, different viewpoints of mm-hmm. past scholar,
yes.
and then at the end, they try to use their mind and intellect in order to get to conclusion.
That's right.
Not just refer to the hadith without thinking about that. Without, for example, checking other viewpoints of scholars.
Mm-hmm.
The ending point is conclusion by intellect.
Yes,
but
right.
of course, yes, the base is the verses of Quran and hadith of 14 Masumin.
That's all right.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. La ilaha illallah.
La ilaha illallah. Sociopolitically, Sayyid Ali Tabatabai was very much active too, especially in the city of Karbala. What were his main achievements?
Yes, as you rightly mentioned, he was also active in different, let's say, fields, particularly in some of the social or political kind of affairs of the people. Because at that times, it happened sometimes that some of the Wahhabi groups, they were trying to attack the city, the holy city of Karbala. That's why this Allama tried to protect and safeguard the city against the attacks that were leveled against Karbala by the, say, Wahhabis.
Okay.
So he built, I think, a very thick and very, let's mm-hmm. say, strong kind of wall around the city of Karbala to protect the holy shrine of the Imam and to protect the people of Karbala.
It was like
Karbala.
A saving wall
saving
around
wall,
the city,
exactly.
Okay, that's
because
right,
it
okay.
was normal
at
that time for all
yes.
the cities.
Yes.
And also he built a very beautiful and very great masjid mm-hmm. in Karbala,
yes.
which is called Masjid Jami' Karbala. And, of course, these were some of the, let's say, socio-political activities
that's
of
right.
this great scholar in the city, holy city of Karbala.
Okay. Another important book of Sayyid Ali Tabatabai is the Risalatul Bahiyya, which is against Akhbaris. What were exactly Akhbaris stating and why some ulama like this one, I mean like Sayyid Ali Tabatabai, known as Sahib Riyaz, you know, acted against Akhbaris and Akhbarigari on that side?
You know, one of the problems that always we had and have in Islam is extremism.
Yes.
Always when we want to think about extremism in Islam, we remember Wahhabism.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, they are extremists.
Yes.
But in the sides of Sunni, as we can call.
Okay.
Of course, we don't believe that they are real Sunnis. They are not Wahhabi.
Because they are not a denomination,
yes.
you know. Okay.
But we shouldn't forget that mm-hmm. we have some extremists in our side, in Shia.
Uh-huh.
Who are these Akhbaris?
They go
so,
radical. Okay.
Yes. What is Akhbarism, we can call them?
Yes, yes, yes.
Akhbarism. Akhbarism is to focus on traditions and hadith
mm-hmm.
without thinking about that, whether this is a real hadith or not.
Mm-hmm.
they don't seek and check the roots of hadith, mm-hmm. whether it was said by Imam or not. All sentences, all words which were written in the books called hadith, mm-hmm. they accept them, all of them, as hadith,
okay.
without searching the roots. So, you know, after the problem of caliphate in the time of Imam Ali, some of them, they believe that because of this problem, we should defend Imam, we should yes. defend Ahlul Bayt. But the way was wrong. Defending Ahlul Bayt by all words that are called hadith made a lot of problems. So they didn't know that what kind of problem this viewpoint can make.
That's right.
Sayyid Ali Tabatabai, I can call him the symbol of moderation at that time. He fought the extremism in the side of Sunni and extremism in the side of Shia, both of them as well.
That's right.
So the extremists in Sunni part, they attacked and they started a war, so he made a wall.
Yes.
But what about this extremist? Mm-hmm. They attacked by their books, by their idea.
Yes.
They made a scientific wall around the beliefs of Shia by that book. So that's why I can call him the symbol of moderation at that time, real mm-hmm. moderation.
That's all right. Okay, as you said, his achievements were really great on that time. And this was the line that was established by Wahid al-Bahbahani in the city of Karbala, you know. And this was how the Hawza Elmiya of the Karbala was changed in the method and the approach to the Islamic sciences. That's all right. Okay, anything missed, Sheikh Rouhani?
Just some of the, let's say, moral or ethical, mm-hmm. Let's say, characteristics of this Allama is also interesting.
Very good.
As it is mentioned by some of the great Shiite scholars like Abu Ali Ha'iri, the author of Rawadat, or the Sheikh Abbas Qummi, the author of Rehanat al-Adab.
Yes.
In these great books, they mentioned the name of these alim, these great scholars, with the titles like Thiqa, trusty, we can say, trustworthy, we can say, and Jalilul Qadr, which means very great, very outstanding scholar, muhakkik, mm-hmm. and unique kind of scholar in the history. Yeah, these are some of the titles that yes. were given to him by some of the great scholars. And he was very much careful and cautious about haqqun nas. He was always trying to preserve these things.
We know that at his time, so many of the wujuhat, the monies, yes. you know, the blocks of monies were coming from Indian, especially subcontinent, because the Shias were living over there, so they paid the homes zakat over there. So, say, like a mountain, okay? Yeah. The gold and the monies were over there, but all the monies were spent for the Shias around the city of Karbala. It says some gardens or some grounds were bought in order to be the source of the concept, how can I say, the charity and the blessings for the Shias living over there. That's all right. About his demise, it is mentioned that it was 1231, according to the lunar Hijri calendar. He passed away in the city of Karbala. His body was taken into the holy shrine of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, and he was buried beside or close to the tomb of Wahid al-Bahbahani, his professor and his teacher. May Allah bless the soul of Sayyid Ali Tabatabai, the author of Riyaz al-Masail. He is mainly known as Sahib Riyaf in the Islamic seminaries. Thank you, Sheikh Fadai and Sheikh Rouhani, for a nice elaboration regarding his life. And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program, The Teacher. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.